Ms. Trostman, thank you. Case is submitted.
Case number 08-7115 et al. C. Westbrook Murphy, Harold Schuler, appellant versus PricewaterhouseCoopers, LLP et al. Mr. Salzman for appellant C. Westbrook Murphy, Mr. Rose for appellant Harold Schuler, and Mr. Shapiro for appellee PricewaterhouseCoopers, LLP.
Good morning, Your Honor. Richard Salzman, I represent Appellant Murphy. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. PricewaterhouseCoopers does not allow people Wes Murphy's age to serve as partners. And when Mr. Murphy was hired, his supervisors told him that his age was a reason that he would likely never be considered for partnership. At meetings specifically held to discuss the partnership admission process, high-level PwC partners expressed a clear preference for younger employees in the admissions process and said that, absent extraordinary circumstances, someone aged 60 or older could not be considered for partnership. The numbers bear that out. In almost 1,700 admissions since PwC was formed, not a single person aged 60 or older has ever been admitted to the partnership. PwC has not shown that they've ever sponsored someone that age for partnership. And the older an employee gets, closer he gets to 60, the dimmer his chances for admission. Wes Murphy was qualified for partnership. He helped to build the RAS practice into a booming practice. He brought in lots of revenue. He managed many engagements extremely well. And he supervised the two much younger employees who leapfrogged him into the partnership. The district court weighed evidence, ignored evidence, and resolved key disputes of fact in favor of PwC on summary judgment. That was error, and we ask this court to overturn that grant of summary judgment. Perhaps the most important example of the district court's fact finding was his...
Excuse me a second. pardon me. The appellees raised, and you responded in your reply brief to the argument that admission to partnership is not covered by the amendment to the ADEA extending the time for filing. That's a threshold issue here, isn't it not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, that it's not covered by the amendment to the ADA.
The Lilly Ledbetter amendment.
Well, that's an issue that really applies to Mr. Schuler.
Does it not apply to you at all?
It does not, Your Honor. PwC has not raised a timeliness challenge with respect to Mr. Murphy's.
So what years are you talking about?
Our claim, Judge Ginsburg, for Mr. Murphy deals with the admission cycle for the year 2000, 2001, and 2004. And it's undisputed with respect to Mr. Murphy that he timely filed complaints with the Office of Human Rights.
Thank you.
Yes. The most important example of the district court's fact-finding...
How old was he in 2000?
He was turning 60, Judge Randolph. So at the time that Mr. Bench, his supervisor, wanted to promote Mr. Murphy, he wanted to promote him to the managing director, which would have been the highest professional position just below partner. And our contention is that Mr...
Financially, what is the, is it 5-year rule or What? Explain that to me.
Yes, Judge Randolph. The way the firm was structured at the time was that partners had to retire at 60, absent exceptional circumstances. There were they would, in some situations, be allowed to retire at age 61 or 62, under no circumstances beyond 62. The partner retirement program stipulated that benefits would only vest after 5 years of partnership. So, in effect, people who were 55, between 55 and 60, would suffer a financial penalty by becoming partner. Exactly, Judge Randolph.
Assuming that the 60 or 62 rule was valid.
Exactly, which we challenge its validity, Judge Randolph.
It was for that reason, was it not, that the district judge concluded that Murphy indicated he wasn't interested in becoming partner because it wasn't financially advantageous to him?
Well, he found as a factual matter that Mr. Murphy was not interested or that PwC didn't reasonably believe he was interested, and we think that's wrong both factually and legally. It's wrong factually because Mr. Bench certainly knew that Mr. Murphy was interested in career advancement and had tried to promote him at the very same time that he needed partners. But we think it's invalid as a legal
conversation where it was explained to him but wouldn't be financially advantageous to him.
Right. He was told that at the time that he was hired, but he was told it's because of his age and the way that the retirement program works. So, but the idea that PwC could defend the case based on a representation that we never believed he was interested in partnership, in our view, is not an age-neutral defense. Imagine, for example, if you had a partnership where they didn't want women to be partners. They came up with a rule that said if a woman is made a partner, your compensation will immediately be reduced in half. And then the firm said, well, we never imagined that you would want a woman, would want to have your compensation reduced in half, so we never thought you'd be interested in partnership and we never considered you. That is exactly what they're saying here. They're saying, if we had considered you for partnership, we would have had to fire you because of your age. So of course we didn't think you were interested and therefore we never considered you. But a jury could find that the very reason that they never considered Mr. Murphy was his age.
But he did explore, right, some alternatives to remaining a full-time employee.
He did, Judge Ginsburg, yes.
And he withdrew from managerial role for a while?
He did, Judge Ginsburg, and all of that,
And his hours went down considerably as he approached age 60?
His hours didn't go down considerably as he approached age 60, Judge Ginsburg, but Mr. Murphy did, after he was already weeded out of the 2000 admissions cycle. Mm-hmm. So these were things that could not have motivated PwC at the time of that admission cycle.
He had, 600 billable hours? Is that one of these years?
Your Honor, his billable hours were always in the 900, 1,000 range up to the time of the first admission for partnership. He was told in his hiring memo by Mr. Bench that he would be expected to charge 800 hours. He was doing many things in addition to working directly on client matters. He was bringing in business. He was a thought leader within the practice.
Whatever the minimum expectation, he was billing many fewer hours than the people who were promoted to the partnership.
That is true, Judge Ginsburg. It is true that he was billing less hours than people who were promoted into the partnership, and our position is certainly PwC is free to argue to a jury that that is what motivated their decision not to admit him.
But he got a number one rating across the board, right?
He got two number one ratings in the 4 years before the 2000 cycle and two number two ratings,
right,
Judge Randolph. So it is certainly true that he didn't have three straight. It's also true that the firm had never said that you need three straight.
Well, the evidence was that in this particular group that nobody ever got promoted to partnership unless they had a number one rating. So I guess you didn't offer any evidence that the ratings were age driven.
Well, we do. Yes, we did offer that evidence, Judge, and we think the jury could find it. The evidence was that Mr. Bench had identified years before ever sponsoring any of these younger candidates for partnership, had identified them in writing as candidates for partnership. And Mr. Bench also had testified in his deposition that there was a correlation between what these things called engagement ratings are and an annual overall evaluation. Mr. Murphy always got very high ratings on his engagement evaluations, one ratings, but was given two evaluations, ratings of two, whereas these younger employees were consistently given one ratings after Mr. Bench had already identified them as people who he wanted to promote into the partnership. So again, PwC can say that had nothing to do with age, and a jury might believe it. But in a system in which Mr. Murphy was, because of his age, already excluded from partnership consideration, and in which PwC used a comparative rating system in which Mr. Bench couldn't give everybody he wanted to one ratings, it makes perfect sense that he would reserve the one ratings for the people who he wanted to promote.
And Is your statement of material facts in dispute contained in the appendix?
I don't believe our statement of material facts in dispute is contained in the appendix, Judge Randolph. I believe Mr. Schuller's is. Yeah. We certainly did dispute the validity of the one rating explanation. I see my initial time has expired. I'd like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Well, there isn't any remainder, but we'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Gaines.
Hey, police court. My name's Josh Rose. I am representing Mr. Schuller, and I'd like to reserve 2.5 minutes for rebuttal if I can. Mr. Schuller's claim is in a different procedural posture than Mr. Murphy's, first because there's a second case that was filed on which this court has rendered an opinion, and in that opinion this court said that the pattern of practice challenge to the mandatory retirement policy is raised there and that damages could go back to 99. So Mr. Schuller's case will go back to the district, is in the district court, and the only question here really is what parts of this case should go back. The district court did not address the 1999-2000 partnership cycle when Mr. Schuller was proposed for partner by the head of his practice.
Well, you said his case is in the district court?
He filed two cases, Your Honor. The district court determined practice was not a single practice,
right,
but was a bunch of discrete acts. And the only thing that was ruled upon here was the 2001 partnership cycle. When Mr. Schuller was never proposed at all, the court said that the 1999-2000 and 2000 cycles, 1999, Mr. Schuller was the sole person proposed. He was clearly the best person in the practice. He was the only one proposed by the head of the practice.
Were they consolidated, his two cases?
They haven't been. We believe they should be.
If they were, we wouldn't have jurisdiction over your appeal.
The district court decided to rule on the 2001 promotion cycle and decided that the 1999 and 2000 promotion cycles should be separate after having seen the appeal in this court, the opinion of 2008 in this court. And the first error is a fairly simple one. The 99 cycle should have been included and the 2000 cycle should have been included simply because the New York Human Rights Act has a 3-year limitations period. This case was filed in 2002, and the 3 years wasn't up yet. The court said that the court ruled that the New York Human Rights Law did not cover the effects in Washington that of a decision made in New York. This court reversed that in the 2008 ruling at 514 F3rd 1365, by saying that the act in New York, if it's discriminatory, is actionable by a person who is affected by it and who lives outside of New York. Mr. Schuller worked in D.C. The decision to reject him was made in New York. That reasoning has been adopted by the Appellate Division of New York in a 2009 case called Hoffman versus Parade, which is not in our briefing. It's 878 New York 2nd, NYS 2nd 320. It's the first Appellate Department, 2009. It was decided in May. It's clear the New York law does cover these. The 3-year limitations period is operative because there were New York acts. As Mr. Bench testified, and this is near page 471 of the appendix, I believe part of the sentence didn't make it into the appendix, but we can certainly supplement the rest of the sentence. My recollection is I received a call from New York. Mr. Bench says he put up the nomination form. He sent it to New York. He received a call from New York. Don't recall who it was from, but the person said there was no support. And that was all he heard about it. That's how he knew that Mr. Shuler's nomination was dead. The decision was, the only evidence we have about the decision comes from a Mr. Moritz. Mr. Moritz is currently the head of Price Waterhouse U.S. operations. He's the chairman of the board. At the time, he was on the management team of the banking practice, as he puts it. He voted against Mr. Shuler. He doesn't remember why exactly. He offered some speculation as to why it might have been, but he didn't remember actually why. There is actually no evidence as to why Mr. Shuler was rejected in 1999. They have not made their burden of production on a reasonable factor other than age. Mr. Moritz does say that it wasn't a majority vote situation. He had a committee that would canvass partners and find out what the partners were thinking. But the decision was made by his discussions in the management team, and the decision was not to send Mr. Shuler out for soundings, not to go to the formal partnership decision process. The only argument PwC makes against or in favor of having rejected him is that there were inadequate numbers of soundings. Well, the evidence is clear. Mr. Shuler never went to soundings. The management committee did a canvass. The canvass was voted against by the partner several levels above Mr. Bench, several levels above the practice Mr. Shuler was in. That partner said no. A reasonable jury could find that age was the reason he said no. The numbers are clear here. Odds of becoming a partner if you're under age 40 are on the order of 69%, according to our expert report. If you're over age 55, it's on the order of 0.36% chance of becoming a partner. And it's more than 10 standard deviations between under 40 and over 40. They complained that we didn't have good data on who applied. Well, there are no records of who applied. Under the Supreme Court case in Hazelwood, you used the best evidence you got. The best evidence we had of the pool here was the pool of people who were managing directors. We made an assumption that managing directors all want to be partners, and the evidence is clear. If you're under 40, your chances of becoming a partner for managing director are much higher than if you're under 40.
Why that assumption, that everyone wanted to become a partner?
Well, managing directors make substantially less money than partners in general. Partner is a more prestigious title. We know our people wanted to do it, and there is no record as to who else wanted to.
I understand that your people wanted to. Your two clients here wanted to, but you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people.
Right? Well, there's nothing.
Is there any reason it's different than a law firm, where some people want to remain in part-time positions or counsel positions?
It's a question of fact, Your Honor. There is no proof that people didn't want to. We made an assumption because that was the best evidence we had. We had the numbers of managing directors. There is no application process. There's no way to know who applied. You have to use something to approximate the statistics. The statistics here are so gross. 99.8% of people who make partner are under 55. They admit they've never considered a person over 60 for partnership. The mandatory.
How would a person over 60 be admitted to the partnership for a nanosecond until they then retire under the partnership?
Our challenge is to the mandatory retirement requirement because it has the effect of preventing employees from being promoted to partner. That's the challenge we seek to raise here. The district court found it not relevant. We think it should have been addressed and it should be remanded for its consideration.
And insofar as you're raising it under the ADEA, what is your answer to the defendant's argument that the time limit wasn't extended for that?
Well, the first answer is the New York Human Rights Act is parallel to the ADEA and the three-year period applies. The second answer
if you're right about that, and I think you probably are, is that sufficient?
It is, Your Honor.
Reserves your claim.
The second answer is the reason given in the 2008 opinion of this court that the practice is ongoing and it goes back to the beginning and continues to the present day. And it's a challenge to the practice under a pattern of practice case. You don't need to look at the discrete acts. It's what this court has already held in the other panel.
That was before, yes, well, okay. Before the Supreme Court's decision in Ledbetter, though, right?
Well, the Ledbetter Act overrules Ledbetter, so the...
Well, yes, the question is with the length and breadth of it. But if it's your position that it doesn't matter because of the New York statute, then we needn't fool with it, right?
I don't think it's necessary to fool with Ledbetter to reach either Mr. Shuler's individual claim in 99 or the overall pattern of practice question that was addressed in the earlier panel decision.
I thought your only argument on the 1999 and 2000 claims was that although they might otherwise be barred, the ADEA, that the Ledbetter Act revives them.
Well, the defendant
does
say that.
Are you now arguing that the New York, somehow or another, the New York law governs the ADEA claims?
They're parallel claims, Your Honor.
Well, I had parallel. I don't know what that means. You know.
They both prohibit age discrimination. The New York law is interpreted consistent with the ADEA. We do have other arguments in favor of that. One is a piggybacking argument. Mr. Murphy filed his charge a few months earlier.
Raise that in the piggyback argument in the district court?
It's in the briefs. It's in the district court. Yes, we did. And the third one is a Ledbetter argument that, you know,
Each of the individuals here filed an administrative complaint, did they not?
Mr. Shuler filed three administrative complaints. He filed his first one in June.
And I thought the piggybacking argument has been applied only where somebody hadn't.
Well, the time period where piggybacking is not the time period after he filed his complaint. Clearly, that's covered. It's the few months before. And Mr. Murphy filed his in March, and Mr. Shuler filed his in June. And we think the piggybacking could therefore cover the 2000 cycle through the ADEA. But for both because of the pattern of practice argument and because of the New York Human Rights Act argument, we don't think it's necessary to reach those because the limitations is going to cover those
Where
decisions.
Where is it that the district court even mentioned this piggyback argument?
I believe it's in a footnote.
Well, the
it's footnote 17 of the 2008 opinion.
The 2008,
which is at 120 something of the joint appendix. Let's see, it's 119 of the joint appendix. That's the New York Human Rights Act.
That's not
the piggybacking argument. I'm sorry, Your Honor. No.
I'm looking at 69 to 72 of the joint appendix, where the 99 and 2000 claims are discussed. But, you know, based on conduct more than 300 days before the initial administrative charges, and I don't see any discussion of this piggyback argument. Maybe I missed it.
The site we have is page 123 of the appendix. Let me check there. Yes, it's in footnote 20 to the page 123 of the joint appendix.
Oh, I see. Now, what opinion is this?
This is the 2008 opinion ruling on the 2001 cycle for Mr. Shuler and determining that it wouldn't rule on the 99 and 2000 cycles. And as I've said earlier, we think it's covered by the New York Act. We also think it's covered by the continuing challenge to the practice as described by the panel on the other appeal in this case.
Okay.
Use your time, Mr. Rose, but we'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Howard Shapiro for PricewaterhouseCoopers. The question here, Your Honors, is whether the plaintiffs have produced enough evidence to survive summary judgment on their claims that they would have been offered partnerships but for their ages. And the answer to that is no. Their partnership prospects foundered for reasons having nothing to do with age. The record shows that any partner candidate from the Regulatory and Advisory Services practice had to meet three threshold tests. First, sustained outstanding performance over time. Second, a showing of substantial support from other partners, including in other practice areas. And third, the existence of a business case for making a new RAS partner in any given year. Now, Mr. Murphy never met the first of these tests, as the court has recognized. Every candidate for an RAS proposed for partnership consideration between 1999 and 2004, including the two who were successful, another unsuccessful candidate, and Mr. Schuler himself, had received three consecutive overall one ratings in the years leading up to being proposed. Mr. Murphy, on the other hand, never came close to that. He never received two consecutive ones or even two ones in any three-year period. That, combined with good reason to conclude that he was not interested, made the idea of partnership a non-starter in his case.
What if he were interested?
Well, if he were interested, Your Honor, he still did not meet the threshold requirements.
So why get murky about whether he was interested, which is
much
more difficult to discern?
It was raised originally in response at the second summary judgment stage in an argument that PwC advanced that he had not even made out the prima facie case because he hadn't showed he applied for a position. That's how it came into this case.
Is there really an application process?
There is not an application process.
So no one shows they applied, so that's not a distinction?
No, but, Your Honor, for reasons, as was stated, it is often presumed that candidates are interested. However, in a situation where it was, in fact, economically disadvantageous for the reasons that Mr. Bench discussed with Mr. Murphy when he came in, it was rational for PwC not to presume an interest on Mr. Murphy's part, and nothing he did, nothing about his behavior, his performance, or his conduct suggested otherwise. So that's what brings it more into the case. But you're absolutely right, Your Honor. The clearer and frankly undisputed basis here for Mr. Murphy not being considered for partnership is that he did not meet the threshold requirements. He never had sustained outstanding performance in the years leading up to this, and there is no basis to conclude that his ratings in any event are themselves a reflection of impermissible age discrimination. In fact, as was said, by appellant claims that the one ratings were reserved for the younger candidates, the record shows that's absolutely not true. Mr. Welsh, who was in his mid-50s, received one ratings throughout all of those years, even though he chose not to be put up for partnership. Mr. Schuler, in fact, after he was first denied partnership, received ones in the next 2 years. So the suggestion, and it's really just an assertion, that one ratings were reserved for younger individuals, there's no record support for that. Mr. Schuler, on the other hand, did satisfy the threshold of outstanding performance prior to 1999 and 2000, although there the district court correctly held that his claims for those years are time-barred. And in those years, the Regulatory Advisory Services Group, the RAS group, proposed him for partnership. His candidacy, however, was unable to clear the next hurdle, the sounding process among the broader partnership. In 1999, Schuler's candidacy received an extremely tepid response from the PwC partners. Only 12 partners responded at all, and only six of them were in favor, and two were opposed.
Does the record say anything about how, about whether the candidate plays any role in obtaining soundings?
The record suggests that the candidate does not play a role in obtaining soundings, that the soundings, after a proposal, that the proposal is disseminated.
Is the candidate aware of the dissemination of the proposal?
I don't believe the record is clear on that, Your Honor, although candidate would be generally familiar with the process and would know if they'd been recommended by their group, and so they would know that the next step is the soundings process. But if your question is do they know at any given time that the soundings are ongoing, I don't believe that's clear in the record.
But it would be, there'd be a come a time in every season when that happens.
That's correct.
They would know the general time and whether they are have been recommended to be a candidate.
That's correct.
So they could go around, in other words, and ask people to help them in the soundings process.
They could stir up support.
Just be sure to reply. Or
if they wish, absolutely. And it is clear this has been the process, and it follows that sequence, and that was well known to the individuals here. The sort of response Mr. Schuller got in that soundings process was dramatically different from the response that the two successful RAS candidates received. David Albright's 2000 proposal garnered 22 responses, including 17 in favor, nearly three times as many, and none opposed. And Mr. Levine...
The plaintiffs argue, well, look, that's all just an echo of the age 60 cutoff filtering back into the soundings process and taking all the incentive out of responding.
They do argue that.
What's the answer to that?
Well, the first answer, Your Honor, is that at this point, having taken discovery, they need to do more than assertion and innuendo.
Isn't that an inference they could ask a jury to draw?
Well, there is every person who was questioned on this, both in the annual review committee and those whose depositions were taken, and those who talked about the soundings process, said that the age considerations did not come into play whatsoever. So that's what the evidence is. There is not the basis here to argue to the jury.
When they said age didn't come into play, they're referring to how they rate somebody, correct?
Well, they also said at no point in the process were they taking age into.
Well, that's not very specific to answer the question about whether to respond was influenced by age. It makes perfect sense, doesn't it, to throw away a piece of paper asking your opinion about somebody who is not eligible to become a partner or would become a partner for a few months.
Well, first of all, Mr. Schuller was eligible to become a partner.
At some point he became ineligible. Before that, though, I mean, so it's a few months to go. One of them was turning 60 in the year of the
right, that's Mr. Murphy. Mr. Schuller, in fact, was, I believe, 54 or 55 the first year.
What about the last year?
Well, in the last year, there was not a soundings process. In the last year, after Mr. Albright had been admitted in 2000, there was a determination, and Mr. Schuller acknowledged this was reasonable in his own testimony. There was a determination that there was not a business case to add yet another partner to the RAS group. So that was not based in.
Wait a minute. Are you referring to something he said at a dinner party?
No, in his deposition, there was a couple instances in the deposition, including at page 939 of the record, where he says it was he understood that someone becoming a partner in this small group and given the downturn in the business, that there was not likely room for another partner.
I'm not sure that would bear on his cause of action if the reason there isn't room for another partner is that that he was disadvantaged by age in the selection process the year before.
Well, but as to that, Your Honor, there is no...
He says that by this time a younger person had already been named partner, which probably to me meant that already it's a small group, this guy's now a partner, that's probably as many as there can be, I'm out.
Your Honor asked about the last year. I'm saying in the last year it wasn't a failure of soundings. As to whether there's age discrimination in the selection of Mr. Albright, as this court's precedents repeatedly have held, in the comparison between two candidates, both of whom have credentials, both of whom are quality, valued people, but there is not a basis to conclude that Mr. Schuller's credentials and that overall he was significantly better qualified for promotion.
He makes an interesting point about that in his reply brief, though, saying that, you know, that significantly better qualified standard comes out of our ACCA case, where the qualifications were the only ground for the only basis for the claim that he had been discriminated against. There was nothing, there was no shadow cast, as there is here, arguably, by the age 60 retirement rule.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is not
so
new.
So you're saying so a lesser disparity ought to satisfy the standard.
Well, first of all, I don't believe the record supports any disparity. Mr. Albright's, if one looks through...
That's a separate point.
Okay.
But if there's some disparity, why shouldn't that be enough? Or at least a lesser disparity than we demanded in ACCA.
Well, first of all, it's not just in ACCA, Your Honor. Mm. In Adeyemi, in Hendricks, in a series of cases since then, in Paquin, the significantly better qualified standard has been applied by this court. So it has been applied in a series of different factual circumstances, not all of which hew to the original facts in ACCA. And based on that, ought to be the standard applied here. But going to the other point,
Your Honor, that would depend on whether this point was argued.
Well, in at least some of those cases, in the Adeyemi case, it's very directly addressed and was argued. He claimed that he was far more qualified as a IT specialist than
right,
those.
But whether did anybody ever claim they don't need to be far more qualified because the circumstances are ones in which there's some suggestion of possible discrimination. So being at all better qualified would be sufficient.
Well, I don't know all of the arguments that were advanced in each of the cases.
I don't think any of the cases recount that. Certainly, he doesn't cite anything. He makes the seemingly logical point, but there's no case law cited.
I'm sorry, there's no case law cited for that proposition.
Brief making this point about
that's correct, and I've seen none, Your Honor.
But I don't know why you'd need some if it makes sense.
Well,
something has to make sense for the first time.
I could see that point, Your Honor. Okay. But what it would require, this is, after all, this is his disparate treatment argument, not the one that's back in the district court, and it would require specific evidence of age-based discrimination against him, that he's being intentionally treated wrong. The significant better, more qualified point is there to say it, and because the court does not want to get into close questions, because an employer is presumed to be able to decide that better, and because the court understandably very much doesn't want to become a super personnel department, at least if there's a significant disparity, the court can reasonably infer that the only explanation could be intentional discrimination.
No, a jury could infer.
Or a jury could.
Yeah.
But that's right. But here, I'm sorry, Your Honor, yes. But here, in the absence of that, where you have at best a close call on the credentials, they have the burden at this point, having completed their discovery, to come forward with specific facts that would lead you to conclude that in the decision about Shuler, that at that time it was motivated by impermissible age discrimination, and that they've not been able to do. Let me just...
You've argued that that there's no connection here to New York, right? That there's not sufficient connection for the New York statute to apply.
Right. Let me address that. Two things about what counsel said there. One is, if you satisfied New York, it wouldn't revivify the ADEA claim, which has lapsed.
If you've got New York, what do you need the ADA?
It might give you a New York claim,
yeah.
About which the district court could decide whether or not it wanted to retain supplemental jurisdiction, if that was the only thing standing. But as to the New York claim, the question is whether there's a discriminatory act that took place in New York, and there's no evidence.
We got some votes from New York.
And no evidence whatsoever, and hardly even an effort to obtain the evidence, to suggest that those decisions, that the no vote, was animated by impermissible age discrimination.
What if it's just alleged, though?
Does
it have to be proven, or is it sufficient to allege it?
Well, it has to be more than just asserted here at summary judgment stage, that there is a basis, based on after all the discovery is complete, that there is a basis to conclude that from which a rational jury could conclude that a discriminatory act took place there, not merely not supporting his partnership. And in fact, as to the other thing.
So in other words, if you can't prove your claim, it's barred by the statute of limitations. Is that the argument?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if you can't prove your claim, it's barred by statute of limitation. Well, not that you have to prove your claim, but you have to be able to point to specific facts that would, from which you could argue that those actions are evidence of discrimination, not just any action that took place in New York. There's no question actions took place in New York. The question is whether there has to be, whether the complained about action, which is the decision not to admit him to partnership, whether that took place in New York. They want to be able to point to anything that happens at any stage in this and say that took place in New York, therefore the New York statute applies. I don't believe that.
Is New York the home office?
Not for the RAS practice, but yes for PwC US.
The partnership is PwC US, is it not?
That's correct.
And its home office is in New York.
Yes, absolutely.
And is its partnership agreement under New York law?
I believe it is. I'm actually not certain.
I should think that would be sufficient. That means the voting is taking place under New York law.
Well, but the voting is not taking place under the partnership agreement. He's not governed by the partnership agreement. He is seeking admission to...
Which requires a vote of the partners.
Requires a vote of the partners,
yes. Pursuant to New York law. At a partnership headquartered in New York.
Yes, and the question is whether there's any basis to conclude there was any act of discrimination that took place in New York. Any basis on this record from which you can argue
that? Well, if he's denied the partnership, and if he has a case that a jury could find constitutes discrimination, I don't see how he could have been denied partnership anywhere but in New York.
Right.
Because that's where the partnership is.
I got off the train at that middle stop, Your Honor, which is that he does not have a case from which a jury could conclude that he was denied on the basis of...
Well, then it doesn't matter what jurisdiction we're talking
well,
about.
Well, that's so correct.
Since we're talking about a jurisdiction, let's assume that there's some cause of action.
Well, Judge Randolph's question was whether in the absence of being able to make his claim, is that what governs here for New York, or at least that's how I understood it. I think he's... got to be able to have the argument from which a rational jury could conclude that he was discriminated against.
Yeah. I'm curious about your argument. You may say this isn't presented and it may not be, but if you have 10 partners voting on someone's admission to the partnership and one of them votes against it because the guy's too old, is that sufficient to make out a claim? Of age discrimination?
If there were evidence of that, if the decision to deny the partnership was based on that one negative vote, which, by the way, here, what was most telling was the very limited number of positive votes that he received.
Yeah, but is the rule that one vote is a black ball?
No, absolutely not. No evidence of that, no suggestion of that.
So you're allowed to be just a little bit discriminatory?
No, not in a decision. If the decision itself, the decision not to admit to partnership, is itself the result of intentional discrimination, then whether it's because
of... That's not the law in racial discrimination cases. There's a Supreme Court decision called Wright versus City of Emporia and also Scotland Neck. And in fact, there was a busing decision that was made in both of those cases. And there was evidence that some of the governing body, the school board or the local legislature, some of them voted in favor of the busing for racial discrimination reasons. And the Supreme Court said that that's a violation of the 14th Amendment.
But here, Your Honor, after Gross in particular, what's clear is that because of age, means that age was the reason the employer decided to act. That is, after Gross, the basis for an ADA claim. And if the reason the employer decided to act, that's what I was trying to address before, perhaps inarticulately, if that reason is because of a single no vote cast with discriminatory animus, then you'd have a claim. If the reason is, notwithstanding that, because you failed to get sufficient positive support that had nothing to do with discriminatory animus, you wouldn't. That's at least my understanding of the Supreme Court's but-for requirement in Gross.
Mr. Shapiro, you addressed Judge Randolph earlier to the effect that the allegations would not be sufficient in a summary judgment posture, correct? You had to have proof in a summary judgment posture.
Well, he's entitled to the inferences, but yes.
Okay. But we're not in summary judgment in New York, are we? It was dismissed.
It was dismissed in New York, yes.
Do you want to reformulate your answer?
He still has to have alleged that a discriminatory act took place, not merely an act.
He hasn't alleged that?
I don't believe he does allege that. He has stated that.
Oh, well, here on reply.
Yeah.
Whether that's an actual allegation. Further questions?
Thank you,
Mr. Shapiro. Mr. Saltzman, take a minute.
Yes. Sure.
All of the defenses that PwC has put forward need to be viewed in the context of a firm that has, by policy, said we don't want older people serving as partners. Now, PwC is now making the centerpiece of their defense for Mr. Murphy's claim that he didn't meet supposedly a minimum threshold qualification of 3 straight 1 ratings. But when they were asked in discovery 6 years into this case to explain in detail why they did not consider or promote Mr. Murphy into the partnership, that's not what they said. Their only answer was that he was supposedly not interested in partnership. They then put forth a grab bag of hypothetical explanations. But if the state of play were, as Mr. Shapiro now tries to say it is, that a candidate had to have 3 straight 1 ratings to even get up to bat, that surely would have been their first answer in their interrogatory, which we attached to the reply brief.
The damages for that claim are measured how?
The damage for that claim, Judge Randolph, as the district court found, would be, first of all, that Mr. Murphy was denied the opportunity to have partnership status. That status would amount to an adverse action under the law.
If the 60-year-old partnership retirement thing is valid, let's take that for example. If that's valid, then how do you measure damages? And suppose that you had all the evidence that is possible, that every single partner voted against your client because he was too old.
Well, he would.
What's the measure of damages?
Well, first of all, Judge Randolph, we think he would be entitled to damages under the compensatory damages under the D.C. Human Rights Act
But he would be worse off if he were a partner financially.
Well, he could request, Judge Randolph, under their policy, that he remain until age 62. In which case,
then it's not vested. It takes 5 years to vest. So by not becoming partner, he was financially better off. I just don't understand what the damage is.
Well, but when we certainly hope to get to the relief stage, Judge Randolph, we would be challenging the lawfulness of the mandatory retirement policy, because you have a situation here where, as in Clackamas, the Supreme Court recognized that there may be situations where you have hundreds of partners.
You're tampering with my hypothetical. I mean, if the 60-year-old retirement is valid,
if it's valid,
then you should have been dismissed under 12b-6 because you have not stated a claim on which relief can be granted. That's a 12b-6.
Well, we don't agree with that, Judge Randolph.
Then what's the measure of damages? I don't get it.
The measure of damages would be that Mr. Murphy would be entitled to injunctive relief to challenge the policy, first of all. Second, he would be entitled.
Why is he entitled? How old is he now?
Well,
injunctive relief is forward-looking. Damages are retrospective. He wouldn't be entitled to an injunction against what?
Well, if they have an exception in their policy where they will allow certain partners to stay to age 62.
He's over 62.
He would have been under 62 at the time that he was admitted in 2000. He could have requested, and the firm could have granted him the opportunity to stay until age 62, in which case he would have earned a substantially higher salary as a partner than he would have been earning as a director, and there is back pay loss in that instance. We also think under the D.C. Human Rights Act claim, which he has, whether or not he can recover pay loss relief, he could recover damages for the emotional distress and indignity of having been subjected to age discrimination. And as the district court found, even if he were required to instantaneously retire, he did suffer injury in that he still has a career, and it would be beneficial to his career to be able to say that he retired as a PwC partner. So we think that there would be relief available, Judge Randolph, but we also think that the record here for finding that most PwC partners are employees is extremely strong.
Yeah. The district, as a non-partner, there's no limit on how long he can work?
That's right. That's right.
Is he still employed?
He's not. He retired, I believe, 2 years ago, Judge Randolph. To sum up, Your Honors, we believe that the district court clearly flouted Rule 56. All of the inferences and the disputes of fact should have been resolved in Mr. Murphy's favor. This is a case that should have been resolved by a jury.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Police Court. The New York Act in this case is pretty straightforward for Mr. Shuler. There was never a vote of the partnership. It didn't get to soundings, for that matter. There was a committee that was convened by Mr. Moritz. Mr. Moritz was a partner who was located in New York. He later became the manager of the New York office. At the time, he was in charge of the New York metro region for the banking practice, and he was on the management committee for the banking practice, of which RAS is a small part. There were two negative votes cast against Mr. Shuler. Both of them were by partners sitting in New York. They weren't votes. They were negative indications on the canvas. As Mr. Moritz said, this was not a majority vote situation. This was a situation where he was collecting information for the management committee to decide whether to go farther with the partnership decision. The negative votes were enough to shoot it down. There were never soundings of the sort that were done for Mr. Albright. There are many pages of soundings from Mr. Albright. There are only two pages of this canvas. All we have is yes and no on the votes. We don't have any forms that were filled out. The soundings were never done. The acts that were done to kill Mr. Shuler's candidacy were done in New York. Mr. Bench proposed them in Washington. It went up to New York. He got a phone call saying there's not enough support, and that was the end of it for Mr. Shuler. The court should have reached the 1999 and 2000 cycles for Mr. Shuler. It should be remanded for that reason alone. The basic question we have here.
What's your interpretation of the Ledbetter Act? It applies to every sort of discriminatory allegation or only compensation decisions?
Certainly, it's limited to compensation decisions. The question is what sorts of compensation decisions are covered. Mr. Shuler did file a supplemental charge in December 2001 that complained about not getting as much pay and bonus as younger employees, in addition to his June 2001 challenge to the mandatory retirement policy that governs his promotion. So there is a pay claim here that's raised under the Ledbetter Act, but as I say, the better reason is the New York human rights law, in our view. The Ledbetter Act, we believe, could be and has been interpreted. There's a district court opinion we cite from Mississippi to say that, you know, if the ongoing paycheck is smaller because of a promotion decision that happened years ago, you can at least challenge the compensation part of that, the ongoing paycheck being smaller. Similar pre-Ledbetter case.
So the Ledbetter Act applies to every back pay claim?
It could be interpreted that way. We don't think the court needs to go there. In an appropriate case, we might argue for that, but we just don't think it's necessary in this case to go that far.
I missed this part, but pardon me. What is it about the Ledbetter case itself and then about Congress's desire to overrule it that suggests it would apply to admission to partnership? That was a case about underpayment, and Justice Ginsburg was quite clear in her dissent that underpayment was different from things like promotion.
There were various decisions that happened in the past that resulted in her being at a lower pay level. We think an analogous case in this court is one Judge Henderson wrote a few years ago called Shea versus Rice, 409 F. 3rd, 448. There you had an allegation that the person was put in a pay grade at a lower level because of a minority set-aside program, and the ongoing lower pay was actionable, even though the action of putting him in lower pay happened years ago and was no longer challengeable. Here, the lower pay issues for Mr. Shuler are actionable that way. The partnership is more than just lower pay, and we think the better reason for limitations is the New York Human Rights Act.
So if he were denied partnership in 1990, then do you think that he would be, and then he brought suit in 2002, that it wouldn't be time-barred?
The act says compensation or other actions. Clearly, only the compensation part of it is going to be covered, but the or other actions language does mean something. It was proposed to be eliminated by two different.
The answer is it wouldn't be time.
Insofar as he's saying his pay is lower because of that decision, the pay aspect of it would be actionable. Perhaps not an injunction to make him a partner or something at that point, but at least the pay aspect of it, and the courts haven't really sorted out what that means. And
now we just heard that the pay, from your other counsel, that the pay would have been lower as a partner. It was the dignity of the matter.
Well, in Mr. Shuler's case, I believe the pay would have been substantially higher as a partner. What evidence there is in the record, partners made a lot more than what Mr. Shuler was making, and he, at that time, in 1999, could have served 5 years and been eligible for the retirement plan, too. So that's
the difference between the two.
The evidence of financial penalty is not much on this record. It hasn't been developed. The damages question, you know, once again, we think the better reason to reach it is the New York law anyway, and we don't need to get to Ledbetter. But I do want to say that the main question we have here is whether a jury could find that the mandatory retirement rule and its effect on the promotion of older employees was a but-for cause of the rejection of Shuler in 1999-2000. We think it's an ongoing rejection, as Mr. Lucas said in 2000. Mr. Lucas was the partner in charge of
the... You agree it's got to be a but-for?
Well, but-for is a language that was used in Gross. I can hardly argue with Gross. Gross actually quoted the Hazen opinion, cannot succeed unless the employee's protected trait actually played a role in the employer's decision-making process and had a determinative influence. Now, we do think this case bears some resemblance, not factually to Hazen, but at least analytically.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical. Airline pilots have to retire at age 60, so we'll get away from the facts of this case. And a fellow walks in and says, I'd like to be a pilot. And they look at it and said, well, he's 61 years old. I'm not, get out of here. And it turns out that he has had no experience flying a plane ever. Is that a violation of the ADEA?
There are certainly cases, and perhaps that hypothetical raises one, where there are other reasons that are so strong that no reasonable jury could find that he should have been a pilot. This is not one of them. Mr. Shuler was an extremely strong candidate. He was the only candidate from the RAS practice in 1999. His boss recommended him, and there is no reason in the record why he was rejected. Mr. Moritz is the only person who testified about it, and he frankly couldn't remember what happened that year. So we have the but-for cause, mandatory retirement is effect. The statistics are undeniable, and we are challenging the mandatory retirement because of its effect on employees. That is the challenge that should have been addressed by the court below, and we think this case needs to be remanded with some guidance.
Not a class action.
Well, the class action allegations were dismissed. We think there was also an error there, but it's in the second case that Mr. Shuler filed, so it's going to be in the district court proceedings when it gets remanded, the class aspects. And while we think it was error to reject them here, it's already in the other case, and they should be consolidated on remand, in our view.
Okay.
And the other point I wanted to make is that there was no vote on Mr. Shuler. There was only this canvas, and so there was no consideration of his qualifications against Mr. Albright, and the district court did not look at his qualifications next to Mr. Albright. But under the ACCA test, Mr. Shuler was head and shoulders above Albright. He had higher levels of sales. He had more experience. He had been a managing director since 1994. Albright wasn't promoted to managing director until 96. His external activities were far above Albright. He had been super great in the government. Albright had been working as a GS-14. And there's just nothing on the record to show that Mr. Albright was better qualified than Mr. Shuler. And the court didn't address those years, and it should be remanded to allow them to be addressed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted.